Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
Coming from friends and colleagues in Caracas, of, you know, bombs happening and, you know, explosions and all this uncertainty about...
We analyse the recent US strikes on Venezuela and Maduro being detained.
The first Bhutanese who started kitchen gardening. We come from a place where we grow our own food, our own vegetables.
Bhutanese-inspired community garden transforms New South Wales farmland. And later today...
I think we need to pressure the influencers, pressure the fashion industry.
Experts warn social media tanning trends fueling rising melanoma diagnosis. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. This week, the world turned its eyes to Venezuela, where the US bombed military bases across the South American country. Later, US President Donald Trump announced Nicolas Maduro was ousted and detained along with his wife, Celia Flores. Both are in a detention center in New York. Venezuelans have mixed reactions about this, but everyone agrees it's a new chapter for Venezuela and its future is uncertain. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Associate Professor of Legal Studies at La Trobe University and Australian-Venezuelan Raul Sanchez Uribarri his initial thoughts about these actions.
My perception is one of an academic working in this field, but also of a Venezuelan. And in fact, the way that I found out about the attack happening, as I commented in other interviews, was I was speaking with my mother. She lives in Venezuela. We know she's not in Caracas. But we were talking about, you know, random things, and all of a sudden I wanted to send her a message from WhatsApp, a picture. Now, going to WhatsApp, and I start seeing all these messages coming from friends and colleagues in Caracas of, you know, bombs happening and, you know, explosions and all this uncertainty about what was going on. So that's how I found out. And that elicited 3 or 4 long hours of uncertainty in terms of not knowing what was happening and why, until we found out more clearly what was going on.
So, do you have family in Caracas? Is everyone okay?
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you. I have some relatives in Caracas. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who are still there. I lived in Caracas for several years, did my law degree there and worked there.
So, as Venezuelan, how did you feel about Nicolas Maduro's arrest?
On one hand, when you think about it as a Venezuelan, the first thing that comes to you is a sense of relief. That's reality. I mean, Venezuela has been under such, it's really hard to convey. If you haven't seen it or experienced it directly or indirectly, it's really hard to convey. It's a country that has lost 80% of its economy in 10 years, has lost almost more than 8 million people. This is over a quarter of the population in 10 years. And most of these people who have left are people who are, you know, younger, who are in working age. So you go to Venezuela and you see the effect of this dramatic change. You see empty streets. You see a population who are either older or younger. You see a country completely changed by what's been one of the most dramatic socioeconomic political crises of recent history, especially for Venezuelans who live in Venezuela, living with $10, $20, $30 a month. Something like this happening, well, it's a relief, it's a reprieve. They might worry about how it happened. They might worry about what comes next. But the first reaction might be, okay, he's gone.
So this week, the Venezuelan Supreme Tribunal of Justice appointed Delcy Rodríguez as the acting president of Venezuela. What do we know about her?
Well, by the way, a big comment about the decision of the Supreme Court is a great example of what I've called in a chapter and other work that I've done, a case of authoritarian judicial activism. I'm writing a short piece precisely about it. Delcy is not a newbie, it's not someone that we don't know. She's been a well-known politician, seasoned politician, for many, many years. She's the sister also of Jorge Rodríguez, who has been long being one of the most important politicos in Chavismo, political leaders. Now we're talking about decades already between the two being in different positions. So I'm mentioning this because, A, she is definitely well known, has a reputation for being a technocrat, for being someone who's not necessarily strongly ideological on one hand, or terribly, let's put it this way, terribly concerned with matters different from her field. That's the kind of the reputation that she's cultivated for herself. She looked after the economic side of things, the economy portfolio in recent years, and that's allowed her also to work and be exposed to relations not only with business elites connected with Chavismo, but also outside. So I'm saying all of this because it's important to understand then what her position is within Chavismo.
Now, some countries and the UN, like countries like Malaysia, France, the UK, Mexico, Spain, etc., have expressed concern about Maduro's detention, saying it's against international law. Could you explain why is this concerning for some? Because we've seen, you know, a lot of Venezuelans on social media saying, well, we're not really interested at that in the moment. We're just happy about Maduro's arrest. So why is this concerning?
It's a great point. There is a complete asymmetry here and a, you know, completely different perspectives on the same issue. And one thing doesn't necessarily explain the other. You can perfectly have a situation where, you know, this particular attack and Maduro's capture is at odds with international law for any number of reasons. But of course, when you look at it from the perspective of the Venezuelan population who've been at the receiving end of all these problems for so long, the debate is going to necessarily look different.
Associate Professor Raul Sanchez Urubadi from La Trobe University is there speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. How many young people need to be diagnosed with melanoma before the culture of tanning changes? It's a question being asked by Joint Australian of the Year and co-medical director at Melanoma Institute Australia, Professor Georgina Long. Social media trends are promoting dangerous and potentially deadly tanning practices, with one Australian being diagnosed with melanoma every 30 minutes. The Wire's Elisa Delfs spoke with Professor Georgina Long for more.
This is extraordinarily dangerous. Australia is a gold medal in terms of skin cancer. We have the highest incidence of the most deadly form of skin cancer, that is melanoma, in the world. Someone is diagnosed every 30 minutes. Someone dies every 6 hours, and over 95% of melanoma cancer is caused by the sun, by UV exposure. This is dangerous. What's more is the danger happens later, so the exposure now catches up with you in 10, 15 years' time. A tan is your skin cells in trauma. When your skin goes darker due to sun exposure or a tan, that is your skin cells saying, you're in danger, we're going darker because you are causing a toxicity to your skin. You must stop. This message is not getting through to young people. I think we need to pressure the influencers, pressure the fashion industry. Is there an influencer out there who has changed their mind about tanning, who was number one on TikTok for tanning, but now understands how dangerous it is? Fashion is fickle. We need to use all the elements we can to get this across to our young people. They are not invincible.
So we are also seeing reports out of Western Australia of young people presenting to emergency with severe sunburns and requiring treatment. Why do you think the sun safety message isn't getting through?
I do not know why our sun safety message of being sun safe, get out there, enjoy the outdoors, but do it safely. Wear a hat, wear your sunglasses, seek shade, sunscreen for the areas that you can't cover up with clothing. Clothing is one of the best defenses. Why is that not getting through? I still think that there is this push with influencers, and you can see it on TikTok, where young people are actually saying, I don't care if I die when I'm older. I just want this sunburn. I think we need to get to the heart of beauty and fashion and what is driving that and change that attitude. I don't know why they're not listening, but we need to do more work on that and understand that.
How do you feel your platform over the past year as Joint Australian of the Year has helped to increase awareness of melanoma, treatments, research and risk factors?
We've definitely, as Australian of the Year, it's been a wonderful privilege and an honour. I love this country so much with my heart and soul. And I think we have made awareness of sun safety and the problems with UV or sun exposure and skin cancer. But that's not enough. Australian of the Year for 1 year is not enough. We need to get together as a federation of all the states and put some effort into making sure we have a renewed message that gets to every age group, not just young people, but we also know older people, older men are another group that don't take these messages on. We need to find a way to get through to every group within our society to get the message through. It's been wonderful for this year. We have put it on the national agenda, and I'm proud of that, so proud. But we now need to keep it on the national agenda together and keep a renewed effort with a campaign that goes to the heart of each age group and that really resonates. And that has to be renewed and not stop. It can't just be over summer. It has to be a prolonged effect, like we do with seatbelts and helmets. In fact, they're legislated. We need to have some really strong pushes behind getting the message across in a continuous manner. We've done some things in sports. Sports is a low-hanging fruit, meaning we can make some easy changes. Where there's a will, there's a way.
That was co-medical director at Melanoma Institute Australia, Professor Georgina Long, speaking with the WISE Elisa Delfs. A patch of farm in the western outskirts of Armidale looks different, with rows of green vegetables shimmering under the evening glow. The community garden is inspired by the Bhutanese community and is becoming popular in the region. The WISE contributor from Tune FM, Tashi Dima, tells of this garden's beginning when landowner Andrew Spinks first met a Bhutanese man while studying at the University of New England.
When I lived in Western New South Wales, they gave me a fellow from Bhutan, and I thought, Bhutan, I think I know where it is. It's in the Himalayas somewhere. Anyway, it was a 15-hour drive, and the fellow's name was Shuang Rinzen, and we chatted for 15 hours on the trip out for the 2 weeks we're out there, and the insights he gave me were transformational, and I have felt indebted to the Bhutanese people ever since, and I've been trying to repay that favour.
For the Bhutanese gardeners who come from farming background back home, growing vegetables in the same patch of land is more than sustaining their vegetable needs. It's about community vitality and living a life like in Bhutan, as the Bhutanese farmers farm together, share meals, and help each other. The Bhutanese in Armidale do the same thing here. Tolit Singh is a successful gardener.
After coming to Armidale, I think I'm probably the first Bhutanese who started kitchen gardening. We come from a place where we grow our own food, our own vegetables, and Bhutan is very much working towards the organic farming. We grow our own vegetables, and whatever is left, we share with the community. We have a big Bhutanese community in Brisbane, so we take it to Brisbane and share with the Bhutanese community there.
As the greens grow in abundance, about 7 gardeners gather in an open space and share tea and snacks. They call out to all other gardeners to join them. They say gardening not only makes them self-sufficient, but also teach their children the importance of sharing and community bond.
We share our ideas how to do farming. I'll share you a story. It was December, I remember. We didn't expect that, but there was a big frost. All our plants were damaged. There was one guy who was an agriculturist in Bhutan, and he covered his plot with the tarpaulin, black plastic, and then planted his saplings. And that was not damaged by the frost. So that's how we learn from each other. Yeah, it has been a very successful kitchen gardening so far.
Community gardening also helps the Bhutanese in keeping themselves physically and mentally healthy. Kesang Laden, 46, is an educator and a mental well-being coach.
To go and do the gardening is so refreshing. working in the garden. It's not just growing vegetables. It's more of being there in the nature and breathing the air, being in the moment.
She shares about the importance of community garden for community vitality and mental wellness.
Go with the nature. That's how I would put it. I get to slow down and then be in the nature, feel the air, feel everything in the garden, admiring the beautiful flower, blooming, the chili flower or the beans climbing up. That gives me joy to see. And as a result, I feel so much relaxed. And when I'm back, I get more energy to continue what I have left. Because humans are social, our brain, we thrive when we're in with friends. Often I don't take much of the tea, only rarely when I have time I do that. But friends have been very generous. They would call, "Cousin, come, we got the tea. Sit and let's share." So that human generosity and sitting there having a laugh, that adds so much to emotional fitness, and also because it connects, that feels a lot better, feels energized, and a lot of positivity comes when we are connected to each other. And as a result, our well-being is definitely promoted through that.
Tune FM's Tashi Dima with the story. As Australia deals with a dual housing and rental crisis, Finland could serve as an inspiration in tackling the issue. Past policies implemented in the Northern European nation have sent a drastic decline in homelessness, as well as providing homes for citizens. 4EB's Tony Pankaluj spoke with Dr. Liam Davies from RMIT University for more.
There are a lot of differences between the way that Finland and Australia both provide and support the provision of social housing. In Australia, what we have is social housing sector, which is comprised of public housing, which is owned and managed by the government, and community housing, which is owned or managed by a not-for-profit community housing organisation. Throughout the 20th and 21st century, Finland has maintained a reasonably strong social housing sector. And the way they've done this is by supporting a large number of municipal and not-for-profit housing organisations through the adequate provision of funding. This has meant that they've been able to grow at scale, they've been able to maintain their size, and they've been able to maintain the quality of their dwelling stock quite effectively. Australia, in contrast, has a bit of a different story. Our public housing system in Australia starts around the 1930s or 1940s, depending on the state or territory. But it's after World War II in 1945 that we start the major push to build public housing at the time, which is now part of a social housing umbrella. And this was under an agreement called the Commonwealth State Housing Agreement that provided a clear policy framework for states, territories and the Commonwealth to provide public housing. And this was that the Commonwealth would provide financial support and the states would build and operate and maintain it. This policy framework led to a marked increase in social housing through the 1940s and 1950s. But what happened was that it increasingly got reframed and reshaped away from being a broad-based public housing system towards the government stopped focusing so much on public housing. They started refocusing towards home ownership, especially from the mid-1950s. This led to that boom in home ownership that we saw from the 1950s through to the 1980s. And at the same time, it saw a decreasing proportion, or at least a stagnating proportion of housing which is developed, which is public or social housing. And what's happened in the last 35 years is we've really reduced the amount of funding for construction of social housing. Outside of crisis, we get major construction efforts through crisis like the global financial crisis and COVID-19. But outside of that, the funding's quite minimal and doesn't really support growth in the sector enough to keep up with growth in general housing. What that means is that our housing system has become incredibly what they call residualized, which means that it's really a shell of what it used to be. And it gets reframed from a public good, which is a public housing system, towards more of a welfare good or a housing of last resort, Finland didn't go through that change. Finland maintained its political and economic efforts to maintain its social housing system. And today we can see the results are that Finland has a much more stable, a much more healthy and a much more secure social housing system than Australia has.
I understand Finland has a model called Housing First. Could you talk us through what exactly is that and how successful was that program in reducing homelessness rates?
So Finland focuses on the idea that the first thing that we should provide someone experiencing homelessness is a home. And we give them that stability and we can then address a lot of the other issues or complexities they may be having in their life. One, it recognises the importance in home and housing. But two, it also recognises that many people who are homeless actually have other things going on in their lives. So whereas a shelter process like what we see in Australia, what it can mean is that if you use drugs or alcohol or other substances, and you come back to the shelter while you're on one of those substances, you can be kicked out. So it means that even a homelessness shelter can make someone homeless for doing something that is perceived as not good or undesirable. The problem is that we have a lot of people that are homeless because of complex needs, including drug abuse. So what the Housing First system says is, let's forget about that. The focus is on housing people. Once we get people housed, we can then offer them all of the wraparound supports, like social services, like alcohol and other drug supports, that means that they can then start to lift themselves up. So that's why it's Housing First. It's not housing only. That's not the only solution. It's just the first step.
That was Dr. Liam Davies from RMIT University speaking with 4EB's Tony Pankalush. Australia's love of sports is loud and undeniable, as data from the Australian Department of Health shows 90% of Australian adults engage with sports at least once a year. However, the lack of accessibility and inclusion in our sports, like cricket, has forged a barrier between Queenslanders with a disability and their passions. A non-profit organisation has made cricket an accessible sport with hopes it can reach the Brisbane 2032 Olympics. For Triple Z's Lauren Bartholomew spoke with Sporting Wheelies coach Grant Cunningham for more.
The easiest way to describe it is imagine a normal cricket game, but then put everyone in a wheelchair. It's run exactly the same way. We have a batting team, we have a fielding team, we bowl the ball. We hit the ball with a bat. We roll between the wickets because we can't run between the wickets. But because of our different abilities and disabilities, we do adapt the bowling techniques as we can come closer to the stump or move further up the pitch. And with batting, if we're having trouble with batting, we can actually use batting tees to hit the ball off a tee. And with scoring zones, we're similar to an indoor cricket style game where we hit it past a certain marker, it's one run. Hit it past a certain marker, it will be two runs. Three runs, hit the wall, it's four, and hit the wall on the floor, it's a six.
How does wheelchair cricket differ from traditional cricket in terms of rules and gameplay?
Well, we're trying to keep it as similar as we can, as in we've still got all the fielding team, we've still got the batters and bowlers, but when it comes to the bowling action and the batting action, we can adjust those. To our disadvantage being in the wheelchair, we don't have any LBW decisions because it's such a big area, that chair, every ball that hits the chair or the leg would be out. Don't have LBW, so we can get caught, we can get bowled, we can be run out. All those things are the same except no LBW.
How can participating in community sport help improve the mental, physical and social well-being of people with a disability?
Encourage them to try new things. Get them out of their house, out of the facility. Get them to organisations such as Sporting Wheelies that offer a whole range of different sporting activities, but not just sporting activities, like I said before, social activities. And get engaged, get out there in the community and participate.
So Sporting Wheelies had its own origins in the 60s as a small club within the Paralegic Welfare Association in Queensland. 60 years on, how has the organisation seen accessibility and sport evolve?
Well, with that question there, it would be the amount of sports that are now available. We now have wheelchair AFL, there's wheelchair rugby league, there's wheelchair rugby union, there's wheelchair basketball, there's goalball, there's bocce, there's powerlifting, Paralympic powerlifting's there as well. We're even moving into adaptive aquatics, and the new sport that Sporting Wheelies is bringing across is wheelchair cricket. So as time goes on, we're looking at adapting different sports so people with disability can engage and enjoy, because we've all got a different interest when it comes to sports.
And what are some of the biggest barriers Queenslanders with disability face when trying to participate in sports?
Well, from my personal experience, it's finding out what programs and what activities are out there, finding one that you're interested in, and then hoping there's a program to suit what your interests are. And that's why Sporting Willies ticks all my boxes there, because once I go to their webpage and have a look there, I can see all the different sports they offer. And also, as Sporting Willies, as a venue, it's 100% accessible. Parking's easy, there's ramps, there's accessible toilets, there's accessible showers. Everything I need is in that one facility, so I don't have to worry about anything.
And do you have hopes that your Wheelies cricket program will locate and foster upcoming stars within the sport? And do you believe the sport will land in the 2032 Olympic Games?
I'm very, very excited for where it could be going. Last year, it started off with a group of 12 mates from wheelchair basketball. I wanted to play cricket. I invited them there. We had Queensland cricket involved. We played our first game, and it was so successful that it's now branched out into Australia's first wheelchair cricket competition. We've got one in Brisbane and one in Gold Coast. Gold Coast starts tonight. But from there, we're hoping other states and territories see the program that Cricket Queensland and Sporting Willies are providing, contact us, and hopefully we can develop it in those states and territories as well. And then move to regional areas, because it's just not the major cities that all benefit. It's all regional areas. So if we can bring out sports to regional areas as well, it gets other people in the community involved and engaged.
That was Sporting Willie coach Grant Cunningham speaking to 4ZZZ's Lauren Bartholomew. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from stations across the country. With the great support from the Walkley Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headline across your community and Indigenous radio, at the same time on your local station. Check out all of our week's stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on social media. Just search The Wire Radio, or one word, on X, or on Facebook and Instagram at thewire-independentcurrentaffairs on radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shiku. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time with more stories on The Wire Weekly.